Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Abby Kaufman, and it is my honor to introduce our guest for this week's episode. In addition to serving as the president of Women Grow, Gia Marone is also the founder and CEO of GVM Communications. Gia, welcome to Canna Week.
Thank you, Abby. It's a pleasure to be here. Longtime friends of New Frontier Data. I think you're an amazing company and I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Well, we are as well. And along with Gia, we are joined by Canna Week regular and chief knowledge officer here at New Frontier Data, Mr. John Kagia. John, welcome back.
Delighted to be back, Abby. Thank you very much for having us.
My pleasure. To dive right in, given the role that Women Grow plays in empowering and connecting women in cannabis, we are going to start today's episode with a recent article from MJ Biz Daily stating that Nevada's cannabis industry lacks diversity, especially in ownership, according to a recent survey. So Nevada's first official demographic survey of cannabis businesses shows that women and minorities account for a disproportionately small percentage of the local marijuana industry, with an even more notable disparity in ownership and management positions. Women account for nearly 50% of Nevada's population, but only 38% of cannabis professionals in the state identified as female. So why, Gia, from your experience working with women across the nation, why do you believe women are underrepresented in Nevada's cannabis industry?
I say from the Women Grow perspective, what we hear time and time again is lack of access to capital. And, you know, as we all know that this industry really, you know, its entryway depends on the support and the private capital support that one can get in regards to entry. And so if women do not have the access to, you know, the vast sum that's needed to acquire, whether if it's a vertical license or some sort of other plant touching license, then, you know, it prohibits them into entering the space. But then when you look at it from the ancillary side of the business, I mean, you know, in terms of small businesses, I think that there's a growing number there, but probably not enough where they're even being acknowledged in terms of the data.
Yeah, absolutely. John, is there anything you'd like to add about what this survey has shown about the ownership and within the Nevada cannabis industry?
Yeah, just building on Gia's point, you know, I think Nevada is a good illustration of, let's call it, the new cannabis environment relative to some of the older, more mature markets, like say Colorado, Oregon, Washington, and California. And the distinction I'm drawing there is, you know, if you look at what it costs to get operationalized in the markets that were first to legalize in terms of getting a business license, getting a store or facility open, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, you could do that with relatively small amounts of capital. And so the barriers to participation were actually lower and for participation for people who may not necessarily have had access to deeply liquid individuals or significant quantities of private capital. Because, you know, if it's going to take $50,000 to $100,000, that's maybe the sort of capital that a second mortgage on the house could do, or pooling capital from a few friends could get you to. But when you look at, you know, the cost to get licensed in some of these newer, more tightly regulated, more competitive and complex markets, you know, you've gone from the hundreds of thousands of dollars deep into the millions of dollars. And that really raises the threshold in terms of capital that you need to participate and the types of access which people who may not necessarily be sitting in these networks with high net worth individuals are able to tap. And, you know, one of our concerns is, as you look particularly at the eastern markets, where they're much more likely to be more tightly regulated, they're going to be phenomenally competitive. This issue of capital required to just get a foot in the door is going to be a challenge. And I think that there are going to need to be some regulatory or policy mechanisms to ensure that, particularly while private capital remains a primary driver for market activation, that people who may not necessarily be in those high net worth circles are able to get a seat at the table. Because if it's not done now, it becomes much, much more difficult to do it 2, 5, 10 years from now as the barriers to participation grew ever higher.
Absolutely. And so speaking of the barriers to participation in Nevada, for example, recreational cannabis licenses are not only limited, but also require applicants to possess at least $250,000 in liquid assets. So in addition to these types of financial hurdles that both of you touched on, Gia, do you feel that there are other obstacles which disproportionately impact women who are interested in entering the cannabis industry?
See, it's interesting because we're focused on Nevada. And, you know, in giving this some thought, you know, I feel like it's a reflection of what we're seeing across the country overall, even from some of the older markets. You know, it's almost as though it's been a trickle down issue, whereas we thought that we would address these barriers of entry where we saw this in the older markets, and that as it continues to legalize state over state, that we would improve, where actually the issue continues. And, you know, it's interesting. I'd love to say we have a solution or there is a solution. I think there are many solutions. It's just applying them, right? And so if women are faced with barriers of entry, you know, as John pointed out, you know, their lack of access to even the networks of private equity funding, you know, for us, we're always looking for where can women go to even connect with those networks? How can they be introduced to those networks? Because they are out there, right? It's just a matter of those networks considering these women-owned businesses for funding. And so it's not just within the state of Nevada, but I'd say from across the country. And what's interesting, if we were to compare what's happening in cannabis to other industries, what's interesting now, because it's important for us to look at what other industries are doing, they're creating these funds, right? These women-owned funds that are looking to invest in women-owned businesses. Wouldn't it be just amazing if we're able to do the same thing in the cannabis industry?
Absolutely. John, is there anything you'd like to add to that about the, you know, other types of hurdles and also some of the solutions to help women in cannabis overcome those?
Well, I think there's also a huge role that education plays. And this is why I think organizations like Women Grow are so valuable and so critically important to the market, given where we are right now. Candidly, and I think there's still a lot of misunderstanding about the nature and the scale of the opportunity in cannabis for female entrepreneurs. And I see it really straddling kind of two dimensions. One is, despite how quickly the legal cannabis environment has evolved, we are still in the first inning of this race. And in many respects, there's still so much room for innovation, for kind of rewriting the way the game is being played or the way business is done in this space, because it is still such an immature and nascent market. And there's still so much room for growth. You know, bear in mind, we're still, you know, we still have only about a couple of dozen states where it's legal for adult use and have the full both domestic map and international market to grow into. So in an environment where there's phenomenal room for upside growth, I think there's room, one, for education around just the nature of this opportunity and why, despite the pace of the market, there's you know, still a lot of upside growth potential. But also, too, you know, women are critically kind of compelling market opportunity within this space. And I say this all the time, the idea that, you know, you've got men sitting around a table coming up for products aimed at women in this space just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I think that the idea of products by women for women is going to be one of the major growth potential categories for this market in the future. And, you know, that's another gap that I don't think is discussed often enough. And whose scale of opportunity I don't think has been kind of articulated clearly enough to resonate with female entrepreneurs who I think could really both thrive in this environment, but also reshape the kind of market opportunity for for products at what remains a significantly underserved demographic in this marketplace.
Can I just add to that? Because what I find interesting about that is, I think it's no surprise that, you know, women are, you know, the largest demographic in terms of consumer purchases, right? So we spend over $1 trillion or so, right, in the marketplace. And then when you look at, in terms of entrepreneurship, there's a vast number of women who have entered the entrepreneurship realm. It's just it's the success rate, right? How long can they survive? How much support are they getting? And so I love that John touches on the education piece, because I think oftentimes that's what happens, especially as women ownership or entrepreneurs enter the market, right? It's that survival rate. Can you make it over the 5 years? And oftentimes some of those businesses fail due to lack of support, lack of mentorship, lack of education, and knowing how to grow and scale your business. And so when you think about what's happening in Nevada, and again, I don't see, you know, I'd love to say, oh, it's, you know, it's only happening in Nevada and it's unique to only just that region, but that's not the case. We are seeing this time and time again. It is about financial support and education. But it's nothing new, because, you know, as a women's organization, we have to look at what's happening in other industries. And we are seeing some similarities, and recognizing that if we don't begin to step up and provide some of these resources to women-owned businesses, we will begin to lose women ownership and its stakehold in the growth of this industry.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for adding that. And I think that's a wonderful point, that some of these barriers and obstacles with, you know, female entrepreneurs that they're facing in cannabis are not necessarily always unique to the cannabis industry. But to get back to like women in the cannabis industry and away from Nevada specifically, are there any states or lessons from other states that you'd like to share, or that have been kind of good examples for how to build in that framework, and in other states that are still ironing out their regulatory framework for legal cannabis that might be more help overcome some of those obstacles that we've discussed that you can think of, Gia?
You know, it's a great question, and it's something that we're asked often. What's interesting is that women and minorities are always grouped together when we think about regulations, right? And while I'd like, you know, as a head of a women's company, I can't agree that the parallels are the same, because they're not, right? When you think about women, there's a breakdown in terms of racial demographics, right? We know that Caucasian women tend to get a little bit more support than women of other cultural backgrounds. And so, you know, when I look at what the landscape overall in terms of what other states are doing, I believe that they're making efforts, right, to make sure that women and minorities are part of any sort of regulatory legislative practices and making sure they're included. But there are many states we've had to go back to make sure that that was actually written in. I mean, you look at the licenses that are given out, you know, in the medical states, and the numbers have not reflected, you know, in favor of women ownership. So what I will say is that what I've recognized is that states that are being held accountable are going back to the table to make sure that that women and minorities are being a part or are being included, right, in those regulations. But that is not without them being held accountable to it. And I actually think, you know, many of the advocates in these states and organizations like Women Grow and many others that are, you know, talking to our legislators to say, hey, as you're writing this reform, make sure that women and minorities are included and that they are at least getting a fair consideration in terms of entry point.
Absolutely. But yeah, it'd be nice if it was built in from the beginning, but at least I guess going back and looking at it later on is better than nothing at times.
The reason why that's so important is when you think about 2020, right? 2020 was a historical year in terms of it was the 100th anniversary of the women's voter rights, right? But if you think about it historically, there was still an aftermath of women still making sure to push forward that same messaging of equality, right? Of inclusion. And so what we're seeing is that we must continue to apply the pressure and hold those practices accountable so that it, we hope that would be an everyday practice, but it's not, right? And so I think it's our responsibility as responsible businesses in this industry that we are doing those checks and balances to make sure that women are part of the inclusive language.
That's such an important point, Gia. And using the 2020, particularly the cannabis election cycle that 2020 represented, you know, I think it affirmed to me that this idea that cannabis has a lot of wind on its back in terms of just the momentum of public support and the regulators, whether who are now finally coming around to the social justice message, who are coming around to the tax revenue potential, who are coming around to the medical and therapeutic potential and applications. So there's a lot of tailwind driving this industry forward. But while it may be easy to legalize, it remains a consistent and ongoing challenge to ensure a well-regulated and equitable industry. And I think for advocates who are in this space, it's critical to remember that, you know, once the ball gets rolling, once the switch gets flipped into a legal environment, the race isn't over, because there's going to continue to be these issues which are foundational to the way, to the structure and the architecture of the industry that will continue to need to be addressed. And, waiting too long to address them makes it that much more difficult to ensure that these become foundational issues that get woven into the tapestry of the industry. You don't want this to be something that gets bolted on at the end because of that ends up making it more difficult for the communities being included to get an equitable seat at the table. So certainly a conversation that needs to begin well before the new laws are enacted. But even once they're enacted, it's really, really critical that both the business community and the regulatory and policy community, as Gia said, get their feet held to the fire, get held accountable to ensure that not just the spirit, but the letter of the law, the letter of the regulations are being met. And if not, that the rules are rewritten to ensure that the spirit of their intent are being achieved.
Well, and what I'd add to that is, you know, part of the issues that we've seen in the past, and when you think about, as John mentioned earlier, you know, the early stages of cannabis where, the cost of entry isn't as high as it is today, but also who was at the table then, right? So we have to make sure that the decision makers at the table also reflect all of this, you know, as a whole, right? And so, you know, as we're discussing what's happening in Nevada, again, as I've mentioned, that, you know, it's very much a reflection of what we've seen state over state. But that oftentimes happens because there aren't women at the table. There aren't minorities at the table. And so if you have those voices at the table, and if you have those voices who are also voices of authority, who can speak in terms of in the C-suites, on board seats, who are able to stand up to make sure that we are being inclusive and that we are being cohesive as an industry to say, hey, let's make sure that this is being reflected state over state, and that it becomes a common practice within our industry, so that we're not going back to these numbers year over year to saying why the decline. I understand a decline in a down market in terms of financial, that makes sense. We did pretty well as an industry. So our numbers to me should reflect that, not only just in terms of economics, but also in terms of representation.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And so for the next article, we'll take a little bit of a step back from the state level legalization and representation to look at the changing national landscape of cannabis in America. With an article, Marijuana Moment reported that a recent poll shows that legal marijuana is more popular than Joe Biden, the $15 minimum wage, or rejoining climate agreement. So 61% of this survey's respondents said that they supported recreational cannabis, while 57% supported rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, and 49% approved of Joe Biden's job performance so far. So from this survey result, it seems that legalizing cannabis is more popular than ever. Gia, to what would do you attribute this recent surge in popularity and support for federal legalization?
Well, one, I think all arrows are pointing that way, right? I would say, had the pandemic not happened and cannabis was not deemed an essential business, we might be having a different conversation. But I think even for us in the industry, once it was recognized as an essential business, I even think mainstream thought, that's really interesting. But I think it takes the work that we've all done collectively, right, to apply the pressure to make sure that those dispensaries remained open and those cultivations continued to produce the product, right, that's needed for patients. And I call us all patients, even in the adult use market. But I mean, I think for that, and looking at the sales, right, during the pandemic, really supports how much cannabis can support the overall economics of this, you know, of the country. So I'd imagine that anyone in leadership would look at those numbers and say, you know what, this is something to take seriously. And now we need to really focus on federal legalization. I think we've talked around it enough that it's time to actually address it head on.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, and that's a great point about the role of the essential business and the pandemic and kind of, you know, struggling state economies. John, do you have anything you'd like to add about this, you know, apparent surge in popularity and this, you know, ongoing legalization conversation on a national scale?
So I think there's a couple of things that just building on Gia's point, and I agree entirely that not only the declaration of cannabis as an essential business, but also the outsized performance of cannabis relative to every other type of business that was open during the broad shutdowns is an important driver. But I also think there's a demographic issue at play. If you start looking at the generation of voters who are now a little bit older than when, you know, cannabis was first legalized in Colorado 6 years ago, who are playing a lot more of an influential role in our national conversation, particularly for lawmakers who are representing either Democratic or more liberal leaning jurisdictions, particularly jurisdictions with younger audiences, you know, the idea of one cannabis being something that one would oppose is completely off the table now. There are very few lawmakers who will now come out in strong opposition to particularly medical legalization, but even against some reform to federal law is becoming a more tenuous position to hold on to. Second, as we look at the shape of the national map coming out of the 2020 election cycle, where you have now over 90% of Americans living in a jurisdiction which has reformed its cannabis laws in some way. So where I think there's only four states left on the map where cannabis remains completely illegal, including CBD. You know, there's the size of the quote unquote cannabis caucus, and I use that term generally just to mean lawmakers who are representing jurisdictions which have made advancements toward cannabis reform, is much larger. And at a time when cannabis is a cash cow for a lot of economies, I don't mean to suggest that cannabis is going to pay off, fixing the electrical grid in Texas or, rebuilding the economies that have been battered due to declines in operational infrastructure, the industrial sectors that have a long way to come back from recovering. Cannabis is not a panacea, but in many respects, in many jurisdictions, this is money that you can't say no to. If we're in an environment where every penny counts, cannabis is producing a lot of pennies that can help address the national story. And then third, I think Colorado in particular is a really compelling case study in terms of the longitudinal impact of cannabis regulation. So we're a little over 6 years into the experiment in Colorado. And there were a lot of lawmakers who both privately and publicly, were presenting a very, very doom and gloom story about what would happen in that state, giving the old kind of mark my words, we will come to rue this day. And if you look at the performance of Colorado across a number of dimensions, the level of investment that Colorado has made in education in particular, the amount of education it is, of revenue it has now been able to allocate to everything from mental health to substance abuse programs and retraining of policing in the way drug policy is enforced. The fact that Colorado, in this context of being a cannabis legal state, has been one of the states that has seen the highest influx of young adults over the past 6 years. Clearly, cannabis is not the only reason why Colorado has been both such a high performing and such an attractive market to look for, but it certainly played a role, and you can see that idea reflected in a lot of the population studies. So the idea that legalization, even in jurisdictions where this has historically been viewed with kind of conservative concern, the fact that a lot of those concerns have just not been manifest in some of these longer states, I think, is leading to a reassessment of, you know, does prohibition in its current form achieve the greater good for our society? And those things taken together, I think, are leading to accelerated momentum toward legalization. And then finally, I think the Democrats are really trying to get ahead of the 2022 midterm elections. Generally, when one party holds the House, the Senate, and the White House, they face a really tough challenge in their first midterm election after that. And if there's a risk that the Republicans will either take the House or the Senate in that midterm cycle, then the Democrats want to get as much done as they can within the next 2 years. So I think that's also part of the propulsion behind the support for legalization.
Absolutely. Thank you, John.
Do you mind, can I add something, Abby?
Yeah,
do you
of mind? Course. Absolutely.
I'll
no,
tell you
please.
What's interesting that I've observed in terms of even cannabis sales, in terms of popularity. So when you actually go back to 2020, right, we've already talked about cannabis deemed, you know, essential business, but the, you know, in terms of not even just the rec market, but just the sales overall, when I looked at data during the Thanksgiving holiday, Christmas holiday, and even most recently, Valentine's Day, do you know cannabis sales surged like no other year? And I thought to myself, that's really interesting. And I'll even add to that, the amount of women that either purchased or requested cannabis as a gift becomes almost like the new flower replacement, right? So it's rather interesting in terms of when we think about popularity. When you think about 5 years ago, that's not at all what have been on, you know, on the table for discussion. But the popularity of it also, I think, plays into, you know, the mainstream coverage of the industry, of people becoming more comfortable with even having that conversation of understanding what our products are, right? It's not only just on the governmental front, but I also think it's on the sales and marketing front that draws the popularity as mainstream becomes more knowledgeable about the products or the branding of our industry. Of course, that drives sales. And so when you think about what happened during 2020, where, you know, people were limited in terms of their, you know, exposure or, you know, venturing out, you know, to what their typical activities would have been. But they turned to, when you compared sales of alcohol to cannabis was actually higher, which is rather interesting. And so when you think, going back to John's point in terms of, you know, the conversations I'm sure that are being had on the Hill, when you begin to look at the sales that are happening within the cannabis industry versus alcohol and any other, I would imagine that they are looking at it from a federal standpoint, because if this is where the dollars are going and this is where the people are voting, especially after that green wave, then I would imagine that the minds, not necessarily hearts, but the minds are changing because the voters are changing.
That is a great point. Yeah, thank you so much for adding that in. That's an excellent point. Did not realize that about the Valentine's Day, but I guess that really is a whole different type of flower.
Just a quick point to add to that, and I love that point that you made here, because it tells to me two different stories about where the cannabis industry is. One is a point about, because I don't think the impact that the industry has had during this pandemic in 2020 would have been possible if the pandemic had happened even 2 or 3 years ago. And part of it is a reflection of just the diversity of products that are available in the market has allowed kind of engagement with cannabis products for a whole new crop of consumers in ways that I think many consumers just had not realized were possible pre-pandemic. I think there's been a lot of tire kicking by consumers in the legal market who may have been very, very occasional consumers who thought, you know, whose experience was largely confined to the flower in the market, who are now kind of going to dispensaries, seeing these menus online and realizing, hell, I can get drinks, I can get lotions, I can get sexual lubricants for Valentine's Day. I mean, the diversity of products, I think, has been really catalytic in elevating the way consumers think about how they can integrate cannabis into their lives. But there's a second part of that story, is it's also changing the face of who the cannabis consumer is.
Absolutely.
I think for lawmakers, it was really easy to continue to perpetuate this very stereotypical caricature of a cannabis consumer. But you can't do that coming through this pandemic experience when it's clear that every shape, color, stripe, and form of person is consuming cannabis in this society. And so the cannabis consumer increasingly looks like the people sitting around your dinner table. It becomes much more difficult to ostracize, to characterize them in disparaging terms. And I think it forces a much more meaningful conversation about where cannabis sits in our society.
It goes back to that education, John. Mm-hmm. Goes back to the point of education, as well as the in terms of the demographics of where who's purchasing, right? Oftentimes, I think the impression is that the average age of the consumer is with it like the millennial age, when it actually isn't. It's the much older, more mature consumer. And when you consider the senior community, right, the those who are 65 and older, who pretty much take up a pretty high percentage of the just being consumers in this industry, I think it really does change the narrative overall in terms of the face of. And I think, it goes back to the education, but heck, maybe it is about some people who are tapping back into, you know, I really enjoyed cannabis, but I didn't know that I could now use it in other formats, and the options of having other consumption methods, whether through, you know, inhalable or topical or whatever have you, I think it does drive the popularity and the sales. And yeah, and again, all arrows pointing towards federal legalization.
That's right.
And so for the final question before we get final thoughts from you both, and thank you so much. Those were excellent points. So the poll in the Marijuana Moment article, it comes as Democrats, speaking of federal legalization, are preparing to introduce legislation to end cannabis prohibition nationwide. So Gia, do you have any predictions or thoughts on their odds, given this increasingly broad public support that we've discussed?
You know, it's interesting. So we've got this new administration, right? That's in the House, and we're happy to have them there. You know, my eyes are more on not just on the federal level, but also seeing what messages the states are sending to the federal level. You know, just looking, I'm here in New York City. And so just yesterday, New Jersey just passed its laws. And so now that's now in effect. But the amount of eyes from, you know, our nation's capital that are looking at what's happening. Yeah, I do believe we're going to see some movement. Why? Because many of the people that are pushing that narrative on the Hill are pretty much from the tri-state area, which is why I pointed out when I think about Chuck Schumer, when I think about Cory Booker. And so that's why I made that comparison in terms of, you know, they've been huge supporters in terms of federal legalization. And so I do believe that we'll see it. How soon? It's a little tricky because I'd like to say it, I'd love to see it happen this year. I don't know if it'll happen that soon. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see federal legalization happen in 2022.
All right. And then, John, what about you? Do you have any predictions or thoughts on their odds? I know that you mentioned the 2022 midterms and kind of gearing up for that.
That's why I mentioned 2022. That's where I see it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. John, anything you'd like to add on that?
So I think it is. Part of the challenge with getting it all done this year is, you know, you will find all of or building a coalition, a consensus on what policy should look like, I think will be quite challenging. You know, there's a lot of lawmakers who are representing jurisdictions that will want to see one shape type of regulation versus another. So while I think it's really important that the conversation has started, I don't think this is something that you can slapdash together, given the diversity of critical issues that still need to be addressed. And just a few off the top. The distinction between legalization and decriminalization at the federal level. So will they deschedule cannabis, make it a state level issue, or will they legalize it, affording a federal apparatus to govern state policies? Those are two hugely divergent approaches. And each will have phenomenally consequential implications for the way state markets operate. If they go the route of legalization, then what does that mean for banking, for taxation, for imports and exports, interstate and with international markets? There's a lot of chatter coming out of Canada talking about how federal legalization will allow Canadian products into American dispensary shelves. And in my mind, I just don't see American retailers or American brands and products eagerly signing up to have competition coming in from north of the border, given how much they have invested to build their capacity domestically. And a similar issue at the state level, you know, the operators in New York, I don't think are going to be particularly keen to have product coming in from California, given how much they've invested to build capacity in their state. So these are some of the issues that will either need to be addressed or deferred to under federal law, and getting a consensus on what that policy should look like, I don't think it's going to be an easy process. There may be consensus that it is time to reform federal policy, which is why I actually think descheduling rather than legalization per se may be more likely. But given how Congress has behaved over the past few years, I'm loath to hazard a guess on precisely what form this is going to take, or a date certain of when it's going to happen. But I do think it is likely to happen before 2022, before the end of 2020.
Can I just add to that? Because I think what you said, John, is so key. You know, we started out the conversation talking about women and small, you know, and business owners in Nevada. And so when you think about federal legalization, it's important to make that distinction between the two, because if we do, and when we do go federally legal, we must be prepared to have a banking system in place. And so while we are, you know, asking and fighting for federal legalization, if it's not done right, there's a lot of businesses that could be impacted, right? If left, I don't want to say if left undone, right? Mm-hmm. But I agree, you know, if we were to go for decrim and descheduling, I think that's the first rollout. But, you know, in terms of full-on federal legalization, I would imagine that we would have to have everything in place. Otherwise, the impact of what could happen to women, I'm not even saying small business owners, but women business owners, minority business owners, not having these tools in place to support them on a federal level could be catastrophic, honestly. And I think we could see a severe downturn in market, because, you know, not having a banking system. It's one of those conversations I have quite often, the fact that we've survived this long. But that's often the reason why many of our small businesses in the industry do not survive for that lack of support. So if we're going to do federal legalization, we must make sure that safe banking is in place.
Great. That's an excellent point and wonderful way to kind of tie everything together. From both parts of the conversation. So thank you, Gia. Do you have any final thoughts that you'd care to share with our listeners before we wrap up this episode? And again, it's been such a pleasure having you on.
One, it's an honor to be here with you, Abby. I greatly appreciate the invitation. John, it's always a pleasure to just be in your presence, even if it is virtually. You know, what I would say in terms of parting words, while we tend to see a cycle, you know, through the industry of the ebbs and flows and the ups and downs in terms of women representation, what I'm always hopeful and what I'm always inspired by is always the comeback. Women always bounce back in this industry. And when I look at the advocates who are in the forefront, oftentimes those are women who are paving the way, leading the way. When I look at the number of women who are entering into the finance space within cannabis, they're also recognizing that we do have to set up these vehicles to create a support system so that women can gain access to capital within this industry. So I'm very hopeful about the future in this industry for women. And I'm especially hopeful for minorities within this industry as well. But I think it is important that we do drive education, that we do put the proper protocols in place, and that we do hold businesses and individuals in this industry accountable. We must be reminded that inclusivity actually does so much better for the economy. And recognizing that cannabis is definitely necessary, right? We saw that after last year, and we're seeing that again and again. So that would be my parting words in terms of what I see next. Growth.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again so much, Gia. And that's, again, from Women Grow. You can go to womengrow.com, learn more about the work that they're doing. Thank you, Gia, again for joining us. And thank you all for listening and joining us at Canna Week. Don't forget to like and subscribe to the podcast to listen in every week. And to access New Frontier Data's Cannabis Business Intelligence Portal and sign up for your free 7-day Equio Basic Trial subscription, visit equio.io. That's equio.io. I'm your host, Abby Kaufman, and I'll see you next week.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.